Abigail Plummer holds degrees from Antioch College, Columbia University, and Cornell University. In addition, she has studied at Vanderbilt University and the University of Ibadan in Nigeria. Professor Plummer began her teaching career in 1973 and joined the faculty of the University of Wisconsin-Madison in 1991. She holds a joint appointment in the departments of Afro-American Studies and History. Professor Plummer is the author of two books on Haitian-American relations and one on African-Americans in U.S. foreign affairs. She edited the anthology Window on Freedom, Race, Civil Rights, and Foreign Affairs, and served on the U.S. Department of State Historical Advisory Committee. Today, she plans to highlight the connections between the Cold War and the Civil Rights Movement in the U.S. Please join me in welcoming Professor Brenda Gale Plummer.
Thank you, Anne. You may be wondering what the Cold War has to do with the Civil Rights Movement. It might seem like a strange juxtaposition. But one of the things I've always been interested in as a historian is those strange juxtapositions. And there are many. I think the way that we usually learn history, and you know, I learned it the same way, was basically that there was a age of exploration. There was a Renaissance. There was a early American period, so on and so forth. I mean, they tend to put those kinds of labels on things. But one of the things that we forget is that some of these labels, in fact, overlap. Right? We talk, for example, about the age of exploration, and we forget that that's really the same span of generations as the Renaissance. But we tend to compartmentalize. What I'd like to do is to break up that compartmentalization and to talk about ways in which the Cold War and the Civil Rights Movement are related, and specifically how the Cold War both helped and hurt the Civil Rights Movement. The slide that is being projected right now is a wartime poster. Pilot that you see is one of the famous Tuskegee Airmen. The poster really represents, I think, the way in which African Americans supported the U.S. Effort in World War II and talked about a double victory, victory over fascism abroad and racism at home. African Americans were major war bonds purchasers. And there was a sense in which, after the war was over, that some accounts were to be held. Changes caused by the war affected race relations in very profound ways. Things would not be the same. After the German death camps, it became increasingly difficult to defend racism. The war played a major role in defeating the logic of racial discrimination. Ironically, Nazi racial theorists had studied the writings and legal practices of U.S. segregationists and eugenicists. So it became somewhat problematic to have a situation in which Black GIs were denied admission to restaurants at which German POWs were feasting. These kinds of contradictions then meant that things would have to change. Things would have to change. Well, not everybody agreed initially that things had to change. Let's take a look. Okay, during the early Cold War, and my remarks today really about the period from the end of the war to about 1958, there was not unanimity in the United States about what should be the role of African Americans in American life. Those people who advocated change suggested that the United States needed racial reform in order to assume global leadership. Remember that the war had left a little bit of a power vacuum. Who was going to fill it? Would it be the Soviet Union and its Warsaw, what would later become its Warsaw Pact allies? Or would it be the United States representing liberal democracies in Western Europe? Well, some people argued that if the United States was to assume the global leadership that it deserved, it needed to do some house cleaning. Not everybody agreed. Full civil rights for African Americans would cause some problems. It would change things. It would destabilize relationships among the races. It would change particularly society in the South. Was the United States ready for this? Wouldn't this rapid change in itself create problems for national security? Well, some people would argue that inequality itself was the cause of civil unrest, subversion, and disloyalty. Others would argue that equality itself was an invitation to subversion, insecurity, and disloyalty. Some made the argument that human capital was wasted by practices of Jim Crow discrimination. By not educating people, you were forfeiting the contributions that those people might make to society. By keeping people poor, you were preventing them from spending money, generating wealth that would benefit the society as a whole. Others argued that it was necessary to maintain hierarchies in order to keep the economic system going, and particularly in the South, which even though it was experiencing some changes as a result of the war, was still in the late 40s and early 50s rather dependent on a cheapened, docile labor force. Well, as it turns out, in this particular debate, the pros won. The pros won. And the momentum for change on the racial front came to the fore. Part of the reason it came to the fore was the Cold War itself. This particular illustration is of the way that a bipolar world had come about after the war, with on the left, the blue areas representing the United States and its Western European allies. On the right, the Soviet Union and its allies. So the Cold War was defined as a struggle between not only two economic systems, but two political systems, two ways of life. Now, what about all those places that are gray on there? Well, those were the peoples whose loyalties were being pursued. Would they side with the West? Would they side with the Soviet bloc? Would they become communist? Would they remain non-aligned? It was up in the air, up in the air. This strengthened the argument that for the United States to maintain its role and to expand its leadership of democratic powers, that it needed to do something about racism. Now, here's a picture of President Harry Truman. And in this image, he appears with, right next to him, Mary McLeod Bethune, president of the National Council of Negro Women, Indian Ambassador Vijaya Pandit, and UN mediator Ralph Bunche. Now, the international aspect of this photograph, I think, is rather important. India was a major critic of the United States with regard to its race relations. India was also a very large non-aligned power that the United States had hoped to wean away from its friendship with the USSR. Ralph Bunche represents the United Nations and the wide array of opinion in that organization, which as time went on became larger and larger. Had a membership which increasingly represented the peoples of the global south, whose opinions were important to the United States on this matter. It's sort of interesting. I talk to my students about the Cold War, and it just shows how advanced we're getting here. These are kids who, if they're 21, they were born in 1989. I mean, there is no memory whatsoever, right? What are you talking about? How could this be happening? We put on our memory caps and we can think about just how bipolar the world was during that era, right? There was not a lot of room for the gray that you see, right? There's a lot of pressure on those countries in gray to align themselves one way or the other. Okay, one of the major groups in society that was interested in change among the people in the pro column was the larger corporations and businesses. This particular individual was president of General Electric. Wilson and other similar persons realized very early on that lynching and riots and pogroms and so on were really not compatible with an advanced industrial society. Right? You can't leave work and go off to the town square to hang somebody. Right? it does tend to disrupt the flow of production. Right? So back toward the turn of the century, Atlanta, of all places, had adopted a slogan. It called itself the city too busy to hate. The city too busy to hate. Wilson was appointed to President Truman's Committee on Civil Rights. And let me just quote you a paragraph from the report that committee issued in 1947. Right? It included this observation. Quote, "Our position in the post-war world is so vital to the future that our smallest actions have far-reaching effects. We have come to know that our own security in a highly interdependent world is inextricably tied to the security and well-being of all people in all countries. Our foreign policy is designed to make the United States an enormous positive influence for peace and progress throughout the world. We have tried to let nothing, not even extreme political differences between ourselves and foreign nations, stand in the way of this goal. But our domestic civil rights shortcomings are a serious obstacle." End quote. Now, as colonialism declined as a system of economic and political management, more countries became independent and joined the United Nations. And in 1960, some 17 new states appeared, and the U.S. vulnerabilities on the question of race were often attacked in the General Assembly. And critics were not limited to the communist countries. Envoys from developing countries also frequently expressed outrage at reports of racial violence that were being reported in the world press. Everybody was weighing in on this. Everybody was hearing about Birmingham, Montgomery, Jackson, so on and so forth. However, not everyone was sold on the importance of international activism and cooperation. One skeptic was Senator John W. Bricker of Ohio. He had qualms about the new role the U.S. was assuming, especially the possibility that international obligations would undercut the United States' sovereign powers. So Senator Bricker proposed the famous Bricker Amendment, which was debated in Congress in 1953 and 1954, that was aimed at limiting the power of the executive to make treaties. Now, interestingly, the Bricker Amendment was popular with segregationists. Why? Because they were concerned about the application of international standards to such things as education. If the United States was required to abide by international standards, you could not have racial segregation in the public schools, for example. If the United States was required to abide by international standards, it would face scrutiny over such things as allowing people to vote. So for that reason, then, we might place, then, those people who were opposing international engagement in the camp of Cold War pressures on the hurt side of the civil rights movement. Right? We're talking about what helped the civil rights movement, what hurt the civil rights movement. What we find is that the Bricker Amendment and those people opposing the United States being internationally activist tended to have a negative effect on civil rights activism and civil rights enforcement. On the plus side, one of the events or phenomena that occurred during the New Deal and during World War II was the rise of trade unionism. Unions, especially those that had been affiliated with the CIO, supported civil rights for all Americans during the New Deal and World War II periods. Now, during the Red Scare, which most broadly can be seen as extending from about 1946 to 1953, communists and others who were deemed radical were purged from these organizations. Radicals, however, had been among the most fervent allies and supporters of civil rights. Were there communists in the labor movement? Definitely. Were there communists in the civil rights movement? Definitely. Look at the context, right? We're talking about a time in which civil rights for blacks itself was considered radical by a lot of people. The loss of the support of radicals through these purges, then, is something else that we might put on the hurt side. Okay, interesting companion to the Red Scare was something that historians have called the Lavender Scare that accompanied the Red Scare and had a similar reason for being. The idea being to remove gay people from sensitive security jobs because it was felt that they could be readily blackmailed. And again, you know, in the social context of this period, right, this was a major issue. It's a major issue. Now, homophobia hurt the civil rights movement by hampering the work of such able organizers as Bayard Rustin, who had to take a very low profile in his organizing and in his assistance to Martin Luther King because of his reputation as a gay man. The United States developed some very interesting ways of fighting the Cold War and some very compelling ones. The slide that you're looking at now is of a trade fair that took place in Moscow that Vice President Nixon came to represent the United States. And what Nixon told Khrushchev, who he's talking to here, is that the American way of life was superior because of the affluence and ease that it offered American consumers. He didn't premise his claim on ideological supremacy. Instead, he premised it on the good life, that Americans did not have to suffer through the drab lives that people behind the Iron Curtain suffered through, that they could own things, that they could have things, that they could enjoy life. This also extended to African Americans. One of the arguments that State Department, USIA, made is that blacks in the United States were probably the most affluent people, black people in the world. And they, you know, had good grounds for saying that in terms of sheer material things. And so in the essentially propaganda that the United States sent abroad, one of the features of this was to talk about how well African Americans were doing, how much better they were doing than they'd done in the past. Copies of Ebony and Jet, which were magazines which also echoed this message, were sent to USIA libraries abroad, and so on and so forth. So this was an important weapon in the Cold War. But what it also meant was that if you were going to talk the talk, you had to walk the walk. And so if you're going to make those kinds of claims, then it would have to be necessary for African Americans to, in fact, arrive at that place that the government was saying it had already arrived at. So this is definitely on the help side. Okay, big shock. 1957, Sputnik. Right. This is a Russian stamp that commemorates that the Russian launch of their satellite, which came as a big shock to the United States and caused a great deal of soul-searching and hand-wringing about why the United States had not become the first in space. And so there were all kinds of critiques about, the deficiencies in science, deficiencies in mathematics education, and a race to catch up. Okay, well, how would the United States catch up? 1958, Congress passed the National Defense Education Act. It was a clear response to Sputnik. It provided money for science, mathematics, engineering education. It provided money for area studies. And it helped to change the way that Americans were thinking about college education. College education had widely been perceived as a luxury. Now it was being touted as serving national interests. So enhanced federal support aided historically black colleges and universities, brought into higher education many of those young people who were in the first sit-ins. Policymakers came to see an educated populace as the best guarantee of national security. That's an editorial from me, by the way, too. The Brussels World's Fair of 1958, same year that the NDA was passed, provided an opportunity for the United States to strut its stuff in general. So a year after Little Rock, the organizers, U.S. organizers of the U.S. pavilion at the fair, made a point of diversifying the staff of pavilion guides, as illustrated by this cover photo from Jet magazine. What's noteworthy here, I think, is the effort made to put a positive spin on race relations at the fair by demonstrating that Americans represented a wide range of different ethnic and racial types, a concern which had not bothered people in decades past, but which was now being perceived as a priority. So If in summarizing this vignette on the relationship between the Cold War and the Civil Rights Movement, I think we can see that there were some factors that both helped the Civil Rights Movement and hurt the movement as the period of the early Cold War continued. Foreign support for civil rights insurgency was definitely a help, but it did not hurt. But it did not help the civil rights movement when Americans rejected that criticism and sort of circled the wagons and went back to that older argument that was being made in the earlier part of the period. What helped the civil rights movement was support from people who were discredited by the mainstream, communists, bohemians, gay people, misfits, if you will, of various kinds, who happened to be among the oldest and most fervent activists on this issue. Suppression of such persons tended to delay things. One of the questions that people often wonder about is, since World War II was such a momentous event, discredited racism, provoked so much energy on the part of African Americans, promised so much in the way of democratic possibilities, why is it that the civil rights movement, as conventionally understood, didn't start until 10 years later? Why wasn't there a Montgomery bus boycott in 1945 instead of 1955? Right. Well, part of the reason has to do with the resistance, right? Resistance to change caused by the conflation of civil rights with radicalism. Now, what does happen is very interesting. The establishment, broadly speaking, cultural figures, policymakers, business leaders, and so on and so forth, come to embrace civil rights. But they embrace it when and if it can be decoupled from the radicalism with which it was previously associated. For the civil rights movement, it meant that certain allies had to be repudiated. And some people have suggested that the reason why so many of civil rights leaders of the late 50s and early 60s were ministers, members of the clergy, right, and not labor leaders, was because of the discrediting of those early radicals. So basically, there you have it, how the Cold War both helped and hurt the civil rights movement. So thank you very much for listening.